from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in today for Michael Krasny. A new and updated edition of the most widely used guidebook for mental health professionals was released this past weekend at an American Psychiatric Association meeting in San Francisco. The DSM-5 carries a lot of weight, influencing what mental health conditions end up being covered by insurance companies and even playing a role in determining which children qualify for special ed services. This new edition offers an updated assessment of mental health diagnoses, but the DSM has long had its critics who call the book outdated and question the validity of its diagnoses. We'll talk this hour about what changes have been made since the last edition came out over 20 years ago. That's all ahead on Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, good morning and welcome to today's Forum program. I'm Penny Nelson in for Michael Krasny. The DSM-5 was released in San Francisco this past weekend at the American Psychiatric Association's meeting, and its introduction was met with interest and controversy. The DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's a guidebook of sorts, the reference book that insurance companies, governmental agencies, and schools look to as they determine what mental health conditions merit coverage, disability qualifications and status, and who will receive benefits and support owing to a medically recognized mental health disorder or difference. It's not unreasonable for non-medical professionals to want to be able to turn to a book like the DSM. After all, psychiatric doctors and experts are on the front lines and best positioned to provide a guidebook for non-medical professionals charged with implementing policies about coverage and protection for folks with a mental health issue. The problem seems to be that there's quite a lot of disagreement within the mental health community itself about the DSM, about what is deemed worthy of a spot in the book, about the problem of fad diagnoses, and whether certain behaviors that might be normal human responses to circumstances are pathologized and overtreated once brought into the DSM. The complexity of mental health science and the reality that so much is still unknown about the way the brain works make psychiatry an inexact science, and many in the field worry that a mental health care Bible like the DSM can end up being more harmful than helpful. So this hour we talk about this controversial guide, what about it is helpful and what could be harmful, as well as what role it continues to play in determining who gets care, who gets coverage, who benefits, and who loses out. With us for the hour are two guests. Marty Horowitz is a distinguished professor of psychiatry at UCSF. He's also past president at the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis and the author of Uncovering the Unconscious. He's with us in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us for the hour will be Alan Francis. He's chair of the DSM-4 Task Force and professor emeritus and former chair of the psychiatry department at Duke University School of Medicine. Good morning to you, Dr. Francis.
Good morning, and what a terrific summary.
Oh, good.
Great start.
With us for just the first 20 minutes or so, we have Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman, and he is at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons and director of the New York State Psychiatric Institute. He also is the president-elect of the American Psychiatric Association and was a leader that helped usher through this DSM, ushering it through its final stages of development, and he participated in the review of the guidebook. Good morning, Dr. Lieberman.
Good morning.
Well, we have you for the first 20 minutes or so, and since you were directly involved in this volume, this version of the DSM-5, I want to go with you to for some pretty pointed questions about this particular book and the DSM. What's the primary purpose, in your view, of the DSM?
Well, the DSM, Diagnostic Statistical Manual, was created to provide a guide for clinicians, principally psychiatrists and mental health care providers, to better recognize symptoms, signs, the historical course in which they developed in an individual in order to establish more accurate diagnoses, which potentially could help the clinician guide further treatment. So its raison d'etre is really to be a guide to mental health care providers. And it's an instrument for use to facilitate diagnosis.
And secondary.
If I could just say, make one additional comment. The purpose of the DSM, I think, is widely known as that. You know, nothing more than a guide. You know, it's been called a Bible, but it's really not a Bible. It's a reference manual. I think, you know, the question is, why has there been this sort of intense interest in commentary? And the reality is that it's not really clear, because of the fact that when does the media, the public, pay great attention to some development in medicine, in biomedical research, in mental health care? Usually it's when there's some kind of great breakthrough or scientific discovery which, you know, changes the way we think about, like, you know, when AIDS was first recognized as a syndrome. We didn't know what it was caused by. And then some years later, Drs. Montagnier and Gallo identified the human immunodeficiency virus, and we had an etiology, and then a treatment was developed, and David Ho at the Aaron Diamond Foundation developed an approach combining retroviral therapies and protease inhibitors. That was a breakthrough. The DSM is an iteration of previous versions of the diagnostic guide that the APA has produced.
Well, let me ask you then. I mean, you're getting to this kind of question of why the controversy. What were the grounds on which the head of the National Institute of Mental Health pulled his support for this current DSM? What is the complaint? What is the controversy based on for this particular book and for past books?
Well, are you referring to Tom Insel's April 29th blog on the NIMH website?
Yes.
So Tom wrote a blog, which I think he regrets having stated it exactly the way that he did, because after it occurred and aroused a lot of questions and comments from stakeholders and clinicians and fellow scientists alike, I called him and we had a long conversation. And it's clear that there's no sort of disagreement between his perspective from the NIMH and my perspective, or most informed people's perspective from the APA, which is that the DSM is a guide which reflects the state of our current scientific knowledge. The NIMH is charged with the responsibility of breaking new ground in understanding the brain, behavior, mental disorders. And the reality is that even though when Alan Francis, led the development and released DSM-4, we certainly would have thought, if you had asked, you know, the people who worked on that, what is the likelihood that in 20 years we'd have some breakthroughs which would allow for some kind of transformative or paradigm-changing aspects of the diagnostic system? We would have said they're pretty good. You know, we would hope that by then we would have some etiologies or some at least neurobiological measures to underpin the diagnosis, which might include even laboratory tests. But when all was said and done, after, you know, the hundreds of people who were involved in the work groups and the task force pored over the literature, debated, reviewed, you know, every extant piece of data, there just wasn't. So I think Tom was reacting to frustration.
But there have been another. It isn't just his point of view. It looks like roughly 50 mental health associations have also challenged it. And I guess I'm rather than being in the specifics, I'm curious what the overall controversy
Penny, I'm a little confused though. What do you think they're challenging?
Well, that's what I'm asking you.
Well, I don't think that they're sure. They're saying it doesn't have validity. So at least Tom was saying in his blog that it doesn't have validity. So what is validity? Validity in its purest form means that you know the etiology, the cause of the condition. In other words, we know that pneumococcal pneumonia is caused by a bacteria. It's not caused by aspiration. It's not caused by a fungus. It's not caused by an inflammation. It's caused by, so that's the highest form of validity, but there's also what's called construct validity, face validity, and these kinds of validity are present in psychiatric diagnoses. Psychiatric diagnoses are not as biologically rooted as are diagnoses in other organ systems and other medical specialties. And it's a function of the fact that psychiatry is a somewhat less mature discipline. And the reasons for that I would submit to you are, one, it's dealing with the brain, and the brain is by orders of magnitude. It's exponentially more complicated than any other organ system in the body. The heart is basically a muscle with chambers. The liver is simply a factory to produce energy. The kidney is simply a filter. The brain is so much more complicated. And secondly, when you talk about psychiatric disorders, neurology, when the two disciplines diverged in the middle of the 19th century, neurology got the low-hanging fruit. You know, the disorders that were much more recognizable could be related to, you know, visible pathology in the brain in postmortem examinations, and psychiatry got the ones related to behavior and higher mental functions. And then, at the end of the 19th century, because there was no way of understanding mental disorders, Sigmund Freud, with his brilliant theory, kind of captivated the group of neurologists that went into psychiatry and led them down a garden path for the better part of the 20th century. And it's only really since World War II that we've begun to sort of redirect the focus and understand the brain, how it relates to behavior. And frankly, we're about 50 years behind, let's say, cardiovascular medicine. It's
sure.
Like if somebody has chest pain and you didn't have an EKG, or you couldn't measure their blood enzymes, or you couldn't do an arteriogram, and you have to evaluate, are they having chest pain from a heart attack, from GERD, you know, gastric reflux, or something like
that? Yeah, the vagaries. That I think is a pretty generally accepted idea that it's a less concrete science at this point. I want to, before we let you go, I'd love to hear you point out some of the diagnoses that have changed from the DSM-4 to the DSM-5. What's been removed, and what are some of the new entries?
Well, first let me say I was not on any of the work groups. I was not on the task force. My involvement was as an interested, I'm a clinician and a researcher for 30 years. My interest was of that, and then when I got involved in the leadership of the APA, making sure that it was completed in the most rigorous and responsible way possible. So from that vantage point, I saw some changes. The reality is that DSM-5 doesn't have any more diagnostic categories than DSM-4 did. It's really about the same, maybe slightly less. There was some consolidation, so Asperger's is no longer a separate condition. It's part of the autism spectrum disorders. Substance addiction and substance abuse were consolidated into substance use disorders with categories of severity. A new disorder was hoarding disorder. And hoarding disorder may sound a little bit, trivial or mundane, but in fact, one of my star faculty, a brilliant researcher at Columbia, focuses on OCD, and her research was part of the research which led to carving it out of OCD because it's very distinct from OCD. And this hoarding disorder is not simply, you know, you can't throw out your old Vanity Fair magazines or something. It's something that is clearly pathologic because it impairs people's ability to live. It facilitates disease because vermin accrue.
Right. If there's just been some collapsing of categories or some consolidation and just a few new entries, what's the big brouhaha about a new DSM?
Well, that's my point. There's a saying, and by the way, let me just say that. Dr. Marty Horowitz is somebody who's been sort of a legend in the field for a long time. I have tremendous respect for him. And Alan Francis is an old friend who I've known for 30 years and a close colleague. We were at North Carolina together. They'll give you their perspective. There's a saying in academics that the reason why academic politics are so mean is because the stakes are so little. And I frankly don't know what the there is about the dispute. So if you look at it substantively, are we pathologizing normal behavior? No. Are we expanding the pool of people who are going to be diagnosed so we can mark, so doctors can prescribe drugs for those venal drug companies? No. What we're doing is not expanding the pie of people who will be diagnosed, but we're carving it into slightly more precise and accurate slices. So I frankly don't. And when I try and, you know, really think, well, okay, there's nothing which is obviously the reason that you can legitimately get so exercised about what might be prompting it. And being a psychiatrist, you know, you're used to this kind of inferential thinking. It seems to me it's related to the stigma issue. You don't see debates like this in cardiology. You don't see debates like this in gastroenterology. You don't see debates like this in orthopedics. It must be still the residual stigma associated with mental illness in psychiatry. And then the other thing is, some people will have legitimate differences about how you define bereavement, how you define depression, how you define PTSD, how you define childhood disorders, and those are legitimate debates. Other people may be stakeholders, and they're concerned about, you know, how their family members will be affected, whether they'll get services or so forth. But other people are motivated by an anti-psychiatry feeling. There is an anti-psychiatry movement in this country. Probably the most sort of fundamental component of it is Scientology, but it goes beyond.
Well, I want to stay very focused on the DSM because we only have this amount of time, and I really want to appreciate. I appreciate your joining us for this part of the show. I really want to thank you for stepping in as somebody who's been directly involved with this version of the DSM, Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman, Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, and he was a leader that helped usher the DSM through its final stages of development and participated in the review of this guidebook. Thanks so much for being with us.
Sure, Penny.
Thanks, Jeff.
I want to put out the phone number for all of you out there who might be interested in joining this conversation. We're talking this hour about the DSM-5, the new psychiatric guidebook, as it were. The number to call is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or you can email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website at kqed.org/forum. Well, Dr. Alan Francis, you were the chair of the DSM-4 task force. I want you to weigh in on some of what Dr. Lieberman had to say about this version and also about what you think is the reason behind so much controversy.
Yeah, I think that, first off, we're in a somewhat disastrous position already without DSM-5. So, and I take partial responsibility for that. We now have 25% of our population diagnosed with a mental disorder every year, 20% of our people are on psychotropic medication. A lot of this is unnecessary, and at the very same time, the people who desperately need medicine have no access to treatment. We have 1 million psychiatric patients in prisons because of nuisance crimes that could have been prevented if they had been adequately treated in the community and had a decent place to live. Meanwhile, we have this inflation of diagnosis so that people who have expectable problems of everyday life, the disappointments, the worries, the missed opportunities, the eccentricities, these are now being diagnosed as mental disorder. Drug companies advertise them like crazy, convincing patients and doctors that these are mental disorders, that they are due to a chemical imbalance, and that they require a pill solution. So there's a tremendous imbalance already, a misallocation of resources, the wrong people are getting too much treatment, the people who really need it are not getting enough. DSM-5 will make this worse. It will turn a diagnostic inflation into a hyperinflation. Jeff is a great guy and very smart, but he hasn't been through this, and I have. I've experienced it. We've had 3 epidemics after DSM-4, attention deficit disorder, autism, and bipolar disorder. This, when we tried absolutely as hard as we could to prevent new diagnoses, we included only 2 out of 94 that were suggested. We were as conservative and as modest as we could be, and we couldn't stem the tide of diagnostic inflation because drug companies are so powerful. DSM-5 started out with a very great ambition to effect a paradigm shift. And when the biological things didn't work out, and we knew that, I knew they couldn't, it was a ridiculous effort to think that we could include biology before its time. This will take decades of research. It's not something that's going to come quickly. They went to the model of introducing milder forms of existing conditions, a kind of preventive psychiatry model, which is just dead wrong. The rest of medicine at this point is pulling away from prevention because very often it turns out that the interventions are worse than the things they're meant to prevent. So briefly, DSM-5 turns normal grief into major depressive disorder. It turns my forgetting of old age into mild neurocognitive disorder. If you have cancer and you're worried about symptoms, that can be diagnosed as somatic symptom disorder. If your kid has temper tantrums, that can very easily be diagnosed as disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. And the criteria for attention deficit are so loose that anyone who wants to get stimulants from a doctor instead of from a street dealer can claim ADD. I think the system is out of hand. We have to restrict diagnosis to the people who really need it and let people who will get well on their own get well on their own.
Dr. Marty Horowitz, I want to bring you into the conversation. There's got to be some parameters, though. There's got to be a guidebook that helps to validate and guide pharmaceutical companies and insurance companies and all these different outlets that people do turn to for help when they do have disorders, when they do have need. So if not something like the DSM, what would the option be?
The option that both Jeff and Alan have talked for in the future would be where we know what the cause of different disorders are and can call them diseases. But right now, the word disorder and the word guidebook means that this system is designed by committees, usually with a certain amount of argumentation between them. And it's the best that committees could come up with DSM-3, DSM-4, DSM-5. And the 3, 4, and 5 are different from 2, which was a theoretical system. And it was decided the theory wasn't valid enough to say these are causal, and let's just decide, can people agree on criterion for putting a bunch of people together so you can do research on what might help them or what might have led to their symptoms.
Well, not to be very skeptical or cynical, but it does make one wonder whose pet interests are being served. Even when Dr. Lieberman was saying how a brilliant scientist at Columbia was interested in hoarding and now hoarding is in the DSM, it does make you wonder whose research gets funded, whose diagnoses get placement in the book, and why.
Yes, that goes back to that reference to NIMH and Dr. Insel, who was the director of NIMH. Back when there was a DSM-3 and 4, in order to get a research grant to do clinical research, you had to cluster together a bunch of people, and they were by the diagnostic criterion. Before DSM-3, it was the research diagnostic criteria for schizophrenia and depression. And the goal was to find, well, what do these people share in common that makes them have something different from those other people who are some kind of contrast group? And so as a researcher, you could not get money for research unless you said you were going to do this in a reasonably reliable and valid way. But the research was a lot of it aimed at finding biological causes. And when it didn't, that's why NIMH decided we no longer insist that you cluster people together by what the committee developed. We have new criterion for
that. All right, and we'll pick up on that fact and also kind of the idea of fad diagnoses, all of that, after a short break. We're talking this hour about the new DSM-5. If you'd like to join in the conversation, give us a call at 866-733-6786 or email your questions and comments to forum@kqed.org. I'm Penny Nelson, sitting in for Michael Krasny this hour. You're listening to KQED Public Radio. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in for Michael Krasny, and we're discussing the new DSM-5 this hour. It's the volume often referred to as the mental health profession's Bible, or at least guidebook. The book lays out psychiatry's most up-to-date classifications and diagnoses of mental health disorders, and it's used by policymakers and those establishing who qualifies for things like special ed services, who qualifies for aid, whose conditions will be covered. And with us for the hour is Alan Francis, is. He was chair of the DSM-IV task force and is a professor emeritus and former chair of the psychiatry department at Duke University School of Medicine. And with us in studio is Dr. Marty Horowitz, distinguished professor of psychiatry at UCSF, past president of the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis, and also the author of Uncovering the Unconscious and the fifth edition of Stress Response Syndromes. Dr. Alan Francis, I want to go to you just to follow up on this idea of sort of fad diagnoses and how, you know, with such an inexact science like psychiatry, research and diagnoses can reflect perhaps the fads of the moment, the thoughts of the day?
Well, two things here. One, people don't change quickly, but labels do. And the history of psychiatry is filled with fad diagnoses. But we have to also recognize that the basic conditions have been well described. We do have good treatments for them. And one of the things I worry about is that people will come away from this, I think, fairly silly series of disputes, thinking that psychiatry doesn't know what it's doing, will despair of it, will not get the treatment they need, not take the medicine that would help them a lot. Psychiatry done well within its proper competence is as effective as any other medical specialty, more effective than many. The problems of psychiatry translating basic science into clinical science are true in all of medicine. And medicine has many problems very similar to those in psychiatry. I think where things have gone wrong is that experts in any area tend to want to expand their area. And has been mentioned, that can lead to an inflation of the system. And this is important because it has consequences in people's lives. The expectation I have is that millions of people who didn't qualify for a diagnosis last week would qualify for a diagnosis this week. And I think they should be very cautious about accepting a diagnosis. It should be as much a study in consumerism as buying a car or buying a house. And since 80% of psychiatric diagnosis is now done by primary care clinicians with relatively little expertise, it's important that consumers be informed, that they avoid treatment that they don't need, and that they seek treatment when they really do need it.
All right, let's go to some of our callers. Jeff is calling us from Livermore. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I just wanted to say I have not followed super closely the transition from 4 to 5. I definitely followed very closely the 3 to 3R.
Why are you following this? Are you a mental health professional?
I am. I'm a psychologist. I work for the federal government. I wanted to ask the experts here if they could imagine sort of an alternate universe where the very complex and increasingly complex system of, you know, billing and billing codes and insurance reimbursement largely didn't exist. And if it didn't exist, really, what would the use be of the DSM? I sort of see this, you know, every few years a new edition of the DSM comes out, and it's kind of like a massive negotiation between institutional psychiatry and, you know, the mental health world and insurance. And, you know, it's a kind of a dance they do periodically. If it weren't for the system we were in, I don't think there would be really much, honestly, much use for the DSM. For example, where I work, we don't actually use CPT codes. I work for an inpatient unit, so I don't actually have to submit coding. And I briefly considered getting, you know, asking for the DSM-5 from our, from the person who buys those things for us. And I just thought I honestly don't need it. It's not necessary. It doesn't add anything to what I do.
Sure. Let's hear Dr. Marty Horowitz.
The advantage of having a shared diagnostic system in writing that people can refer to is that when you're practicing personalized or individualized care on a specific individual, you as a clinician have some terms by which you can search the literature and find out where there's valid scientific knowledge published, such as in even for the public in PubMed, but for you in professional postings and journals that have been peer reviewed. So that's the most utilitarian purpose, is to help you practice a very personalized care where you use your clinical judgment on what might work, but as related to what knowledge people have been able to put together.
Alan Francis, you were involved in the inner workings of DSM-4. I'm wondering, to what extent does the pharmaceutical industry have any influence if they've been working for 20 years on developing a treatment around a certain set or classification of disorder? I have to believe there's some interplay between where the money's been spent and what's going to get recognized.
In my experience, they've had absolutely no influence on the decision-making, but every influence on how the criteria are used once written. And if something can be misused, it's like all advertising.
Wait, I don't understand that. So they don't have any input on how it gets classified, but how they do end up having influence in how it gets...
In how it's used. So that once the disorder makes it into the manual, the drug company would not have influenced whether it gets in or not. They would have no contact with any of the people involved, and I think there's been reasonable vetting of the people so that I don't believe they've made decisions because of financial conflicts of interest. I think it's intellectual conflicts of interest that have led to the bad decisions. But once the diagnosis is in the manual, the drug companies will be licking their lips, figuring out every conceivable way to misrepresent it so that it will seem that many millions of people have that problem, and they can saturate the world with medication.
Or broaden the purpose, broaden the usability, perhaps.
Yeah, so if anything can be misused in DSM, it will be misused. So it has to be very carefully written so that it can't be used in advertising campaigns in a way that will mislead people into thinking that they have a problem.
All right. Daniel in San Francisco, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on. So I have a concern with kind of the growing diagnoses of children that I think has been going on. And my concern is further when we're publishing a new manual without really a lot of new scientific knowledge, and that's going to give credence to a lot of these diagnoses like ADHD that I think we've heard are really overly broad, and that our children are going to continue to be medicated and medicated and medicated. And we're turning weird into a pathology now.
Dr. Horowitz, why don't you weigh in on that, and also about how far has brain science come since I think 1990 was when DSM-4 came out.
The decade of the brain.
How far has brain science come, and is there good reason for a lot of this?
Brain science has come very far in terms of getting a great deal of the ratio of funding, so that the psychological and social factors that go into the biopsychosocial formation of many psychiatric disorders have been more weighted, with the hope of finding biological tests that would say if a person had a given dysfunction or impairment. And that relates to what you were talking about, of course. Then if there's someone who has a medication that happens to alter that impairment, then they will want to pair it and sell it and use it. So the complexity of psychiatry, which is reflected in the struggle to make a committee decide on what's the threshold for having a disorder specified by signs and symptoms, the problem is that the brain sciences have not yet given us clear markers for what put some conditions together. So we know it's a very complicated thing with brain alterations, psychological factors like traumatization, and social factors like stigmatization or failures in support, or even what Dr. Francis was saying, adequate housing, and that all these things interact to produce a variety of signs and symptoms. And those can't even be measured by a symptom checklist or self-report. There's no sufficient biological markers, and that's why all these diagnoses really specify. It's an experienced clinician's judgment that says that this fits in that category for counting purposes, and it's an experienced clinician's judgment on how to treat the person in a very individually formulated way, which is optimum treatment.
Well, and with all this brain science research going on, how differentiated is the research that's going on with children's brains versus adult brains? Because it sure seems to me that, well, first of all, we all know that children's brains are works in progress, so they're developing and changing and dynamic and all of that. But it does seem like a lot of children's behaviors, the manifestations of all kinds of ways of being, are
now almost pathologized all of these diagnoses for kids. And I'm wondering how much brain science is really being focused on children's unique brains.
Well, a great deal is because of issues such as what Jeff mentioned, which is what about a whole spectrum of disorders of which autism is just one? And is autism actually increasing? And what does that do to? And is it due to a variety of toxins or sociological problems or genetic problems? And so people are trying to track down that kind of thing. So, for example, even in the controversies about post-traumatic stress disorder, the Veterans Administration, the Department of Defense, the Army have all contested whether this should even be called a disorder. And there's been a big push to find biological markers of it. However, the signs and symptoms, which have held up for a long time and have a certain coherent validity, they're mostly what you get on talking with people. That is, they describe their nightmares. They describe their intrusive thoughts. They may show in their behavior that they're avoiding certain things, but they tell you they're feeling numb and that they're also having disruptive anger experiences. And there's no thermometer to measure that yet.
And Dr. Francis, are you noticing, you mentioned earlier a concern about overdiagnosing in general, and are you noticing leaps and bounds with brain science that is alleviating those fears for you, or is it still just such a wild frontier out there?
Well, let's be clear. It's going to take a very long time to understand. There won't be one schizophrenia, one bipolar disorder. There'll be hundreds of different causes. Just as there's not one breast cancer, there'll probably be 100 different causes of breast cancer. The science will take a very long time to work out. In the meantime, we have to hear the people, and we have pretty good methods of doing it when we stick with them. Child diagnosis is out of hand, and this is especially difficult because kids are very tough to diagnose. They have a short track record. The developmental factors can be confusing. Kids change quickly. The environmental stressors. We should be taking our time before giving a diagnosis to a kid. Parents should want the kid to be seen over many visits to see how things evolve before a diagnosis is made. And a caller before mentioned insurance. Insurance is part of the problem here. Docs don't get paid unless they have a diagnosis. This forces premature diagnosis with incomplete information. So we should settle down, take our time, be cautious, and first do no harm.
And it sure seems like right on the heels of diagnosis comes a clamor for medication. It just seems like that's the trend.
And a lot of that is market-driven because of the advertising that drug companies can do in this country and in no other country but in the world except New Zealand. I see no reason in the world to allow this or even marketing to doctors. It's not education. It's pushing pills.
All right, let's go to a couple comments that have come into the website. One listener writes, personality disorders continue to be assigned to females who speak out and what's referred to as complex post-traumatic stress, which affects more women than men, continues to remain untreated because the drafters of all versions have been primarily white male psychiatrists who embedded the documents with their biases. That's one listener's perspective. Steve writes in on Facebook, I will not be buying it, and neither will many mental health professionals. I prefer the NIMH guidelines. This new edition is little different than the current one. Few changes except for autism spectrum. The pharmaceutical industry has a tad too much influence regarding DSM. And let's now go to Charles, who's calling us from San Francisco. Good morning, Charles.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I look at this from both perspectives. I started my career as a research scientist, and then have ended up as a founder and manager in a number of.
You know what, Charles, you have a really bad connection. So actually, if you could ask a quick question, because you're breaking up on us.
Well, I just wanted to comment that I think there's a real conflict in industry. A lot of the researchers really are motivated by by the right things, but the companies are under pressure to invent indications, as it were, and to overpromote them.
All right. All right. Thanks so much, Charles. And I think that's a point that's been echoed by our guest today as well. Let's go to Brian in Orinda.
Hi, thank you. I'm sympathetic to a lot of the critiques I'm hearing here, and I'm a marriage and family therapist. And so I wondered what some of the guests might say about this other perspective that I have, which is that, those in my sort of class of mental health professionals, we don't prescribe drugs and actually don't even take insurance. So some of the dangers of the DSM, I feel like I slip around because of those two factors. And on the other hand, I'm actually quite thankful for, believe it or not, having so many diagnostic categories to use. And that's really mostly motivated by the utility of having some tips for where to steer my talk therapy. So I might do a different sort of a strategy on talk therapy if I'm dealing with one diagnosis versus another, which is to say it's not really a question of pathologizing as much as getting sort of a quick handle on a known cluster of mental suffering, you might say, mm-hmm. and then trying to take the talk in one direction versus another. So I'm wondering if that's a valid use of a manual's complex of the DSM, according to the other guest.
Dr. Horowitz, I would think if it's affirming or reaffirming something that somebody's seeing in a talk therapy patient, you know, it's validating a condition that they're noticing.
Well, as I said before, by having some terminology that some people can agree on, it allows you to search the literature and find out what other people have said, so that if one is doing marriage and family therapy and one just comes to the opinion that one person seems to have explosive emotional dysregulation and the other person is emotionally over-controlled and they have some kind of cogwheeling that one's trying to improve adaptationally, and one wants to understand more how to formulate each person's personality configuration and how they're cogwheeling and to read about it, then one can use that kind of terminology that one might have got familiar with. The personality disorders is another story, and we could go into that for a few minutes if you'd like.
Well, I also wanted to throw out there this question of how many general classifications of disorders are there? Just give us a ballpark, not the specific diagnoses, but when the DSM is classifying disorders, are we talking tens, 20s, hundreds?
I think I'll leave that to you, Alan.
Dr. Francis?
Yeah, it's almost an irrelevant question. It depends on how you count. There are about 200 criteria that's listed. But what really counts is the number of people diagnosed, not the number of diagnoses. And one point to pick up on, there is nothing official about DSM-5. It has no official standing. The codes used in DSM-5 are available for free from the government. The codes used in DSM-4 are now still good for the next year and a half, and no one has to feel like a captive audience. No one has to buy it. No one has to use it. No one has to teach it.
Well, when government agencies then are looking for validation in treating or making money available for certain conditions, who do they turn to?
They turn to the codes. But the codes are international codes. They're nothing specific to DSM. DSM borrows those codes. And so I think that there are many other sources of information about psychiatric diagnosis that will be safer and probably more scientifically sound than DSM-5, and everyone will be using the same codes, and all you have to do is get them off the internet from the government.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Okay, so that sheds new light on, say, the VA is trying to diagnose somebody and ascertain whether they need government monies, government help. It's not the DSM that they're turning to.
Well, they're turning to the DSM for information and for criteria sets, for the kind of common language that Marty's talking about. But the final decisions about reimbursement and statistics are all kept in this common code system that's absolutely free on the internet. And people could continue to use DSM-4. They don't have to buy DSM-5. I think it's a better idea not to, because I think it's adding troubles rather than curing them.
All right, let's go to Kathy, who's calling us from San Jose. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there. So I just wanted to comment a little bit as someone with family members with both autism and ADHD. One of the things that a prior caller mentioned was the difference between talk therapy as a psychotherapist and psychiatry. And I think something that a lot of people need to understand is that there is a big overlap there. There are a lot of people who can't effectively benefit from talk therapy until they have medication that addresses the biochemical problems that may be at the root of their particular situation. So, for example, for ADHD, you know, you can say that people are over-medicated, but for many, many people, including both adults and children, without the medication, there is no ability to put into practice the things they might be, the insights they might be getting from talk therapy. And that's why a change in the diagnostic criteria for many of these conditions, or for autism spectrum disorders, I have a daughter with Asperger's, the change in the criteria used to determine which codes to put someone into has a very big impact, because then if the codes that are assigned are incorrect, you may not be able to get medical coverage for the medication that could help them benefit then from the talk therapy or counseling that would get their lives back in order.
All right. Well, Kathy, thank you so much. Thanks for that. This is fundraising time for KQED Public Radio, and if you would like to participate in our fundraising effort, you can find more information at kqed.org. You're listening to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson. Well, did you want to weigh in anything on that point, Dr. Horowitz, about what Kathy was just saying?
Yes. Again, I think since the hour is nearly up, a takeaway thing is to understand what the diagnostic statistical manual actually is. It's the agreement of committees reviewing what they could find on the scientific literature and then arguing out on how it must be used. It then, as Dr. Francis says, can be misused. For example, insurance companies seeking to reduce cost can say you only have 10 minutes to make this diagnosis, and that'll save us money in your fee, and so we're going to pay you less. But that doesn't mean that's good diagnosis. It certainly isn't good individualized formulation, and it takes usually many visits to see what's happening, even if one is given medication. Is the state of mind improving so that the person can use conversation to resolve crises, stressors, and maladaptive patterns? So the treatments for the psychiatric conditions combine culture and social support. They combine working through serious crises and interpersonal disputes, and they involve changing where you can disruptive, dysregulatory functions leading to extreme moods and explosive behaviors. But it's always a matter of judgment. And so as consumers of the mental health professions, people should not believe that they have a disease if they have a psychiatric diagnosis. It's not a known disease. It's a agreed upon condition which may have a known prognosis, and we may know a great deal about how to help it, but we don't have
An etiology
of it yet.
Let's throw in a couple quick web comments. Christine writes, the guest just noted factors about lack of environment, yet why aren't we looking to social justice instead of rolling it all together for a clinician to address contributing factors for a mental illness designation? How much are we also pathologizing poverty and being victimized by injustice? I think that's a pretty big question for just a couple minutes left. So I want to toss in one more comment here. Lisa writes, where do complex trauma and attachment issues, RAD, fit into the DSM-4? These important and common issues seem to be left out. The root cause of oppositional behavior, depression, hypervigilance, etc., can often be because of complex traumas experienced during a young child's life. And actually, that merges pretty well with the earlier comment. And Dr. Alan Francis, do you want to weigh in on either of those?
Yeah, I have two comments. One is psychotherapy is way underfunded. Medications are way overfunded. The reason's simple. The drug companies have tens of billions of dollars to advertise, and psychotherapists are really a mom-and-pop industry. The second issue is I think that it's very, very important that people not give up on psychiatry, not give up on getting treatment they need because they hear all this confusion. that for the people who have the clear-cut psychiatric disorders, you're not getting enough treatment. The people who don't are getting too much, and the social issues are crucially important. We should be spending a lot less money on stimulant drugs for kids, a lot more money on smaller class size and more phys ed. We should be spending less money on disability for people who are unemployed and more money on retraining so that people can get back to work. We should be spending less money on lifetime disabilities for PTSD for returning troops and more money on all the troops getting a better deal when they return. So we shouldn't be solving social problems by medicalizing the individual. It's costly, it's stigmatizing, it's hitting the wrong target.
And is there a way, is there a best incarnation of what the DSM could be in your mind?
Yeah, I think that new diagnoses in psychiatry are now more dangerous than new drugs. And we can't let the American Psychiatric Association and its research experts decide how the country handles its mental health. We need something equivalent to the FDA that would be vetting new diagnoses to make sure that they're safe and scientifically sound.
And would you concur with that, Dr. Horowitz?
I'd ride it a little bit. So what we need is something like an FDA for the psychotherapies.
All right. Well, thanks so much to both of you for being with us this hour. We've been talking about the new DSM-5, and with us in studio, Dr. Marty Horowitz is Distinguished Professor of Psychiatry at UCSF and the author of Uncovering the Unconscious. Also with us today has been Alan Francis. He's chair of the DSM-4 Task Force and Professor Emeritus and former chair of the Psychiatry Department at Duke University School of Medicine. And earlier in the show, we heard from Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman. He's with Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, and also president-elect of the American Psychiatric Association. He was a force with the current DSM, the DSM-5, ushering it through its final stages. Thanks to all of you who called into the show as well. Well, coming up in the next hour, we'll talk with journalist and author John Mooallem. His new book looks at people who work hard to save animals from extinction. It's called Wild Ones. For Michael Krasny, I'm Penny Nelson, and you're listening to Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.